Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The guy didn't get to bed till after 1 this morning. Then he was up early for church and meetings. The White House waits for no man, though, so Barack Obama got right to work today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Microsoft, providing people-ready enterprise solutions. Software based on how people really work.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. This one is the 21st of January. After a prayer service at the National Cathedral this morning in an open house with a few hundred of his closest friends at the White House, the president's first order of official business was to sign his name a couple of times. He's trying to get his administration off to an ethical start with some new executive orders. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is with us to tell us about it. Hi, John.
Hello, Kai.
So these new rules, what's in them?
Well, they call for open government and tighter ethics for executive branch employees. Specifically, there will now be a third-party review of any decision to keep documents or meetings secret. Another one puts restrictions on former lobbyists who work in the new White House. And there's going to be a longer ban on lobbying by people who've left the government. And finally, Obama ordered a sacrifice that hits even closer to home for White House staff who earn more than $100,000 a year.
During this period of economic emergency, families are tightening their belts, and so should Washington. And that's why I am instituting a pay freeze on the salaries of my senior White House staff.
Any sign, John, this morning of what he plans to do about the economy?
Not really any specifics. We do know that his economic team is working on a large spending and tax cut package that some say is going to be close to $1 trillion. The Treasury Secretary nominee, Timothy Geithner, was at his Senate confirmation hearing today, and he said that to be effective, an economic recovery package has to be big. He said to look for a comprehensive proposal from the White House in the coming weeks.
Yeah, he also said, didn't he, that we need not rush this, right? It has to be right the first time?
That's right. That's right. He doesn't want to do anything precipitous. Although, you know, the House is going ahead with its own package. House committees this week are already working on a $825 billion bill. It's a mix of spending on infrastructure and technology and aid to states, along with some tax breaks for individuals and businesses.
Is this going to be one of those packages where the House does one thing, the Senate does another, and we spend weeks for them trying to figure it out?
Well, the leadership in Congress says the urgency of this economy requires something to be on the president's desk by the middle of February. But the sniping has already begun. Republicans are criticizing the Democrats for putting too much emphasis on spending and not enough on tax cuts. Republican leaders, by the way, asked for and got a meeting with President Obama tomorrow where they're going to discuss their concerns. The Republicans got some ammunition from the Congressional Budget Office today, which raised questions about whether the government can physically spend $550 billion on brand new projects quickly enough to make a difference.
Think about that for a second, whether we can spend that money fast enough. Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
At that hearing, John mentioned Obama's choice to take over the Treasury Department faced some tough questions. Timothy Geithner was asked about mistakes on his tax returns, but also about his part in crafting some of last year's biggest bailouts. In his role as president of the New York Federal Reserve, Geithner was at the table with Bernanke and Paulson when the Troubled Asset Relief Program was created. Today, he said the plan's not working and it needs to be fixed. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Tim Geithner didn't waste any time getting to the point about the massive federal bailout of banks.
President Obama and I believe that this program needs reform.
There are lots of problems, but the biggest is that many of America's largest banks are still teetering on the edge of insolvency.
In a crisis of this magnitude, the most prudent course is the most forceful course.
In the past week, Obama's economic teams hinted it could set up an enormous so-called bad bank. This government-run bank would buy up mortgage-backed assets that are losing value and pushing private banks toward bankruptcy.
The thing I worry about with it is cost.
Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York.
I did a little calling this weekend to people who would know, and they said it could be $3 trillion, $4 trillion if you did the whole good bank, bad bank across the board.
Geithner said his team's been studying the idea. It's complicated and could be expensive, but it's been part of most successful government bailouts around the world. Other senators said they worried buying up bad investments would cost taxpayers billions. But Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky said his chief concern was Geithner's own track record.
Mr. Geithner has been involved in just about every flawed bailout action of the previous administration.
Bunning wondered if someone so intimately involved in the failed policies of the past could actually deliver the kind of change the economy needs. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
You can go ahead and hit the rewind button on yesterday's big losses on Wall Street. Investors were snapping up financial stocks today for some reason. IBM, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Airlines are some of the few companies that haven't asked for government bailouts as the economy's gone south. Doesn't mean they're necessarily doing well, though. Even though fuel prices have backed way off the record highs this past summer, back then a lot of carriers locked in expensive futures contracts that they can't get out of now. That's called hedging, and it's the reason just about every U.S. airline is reporting losses for last year and part of this year, too. But still, nobody's come up with a better alternative. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Airlines release fourth quarter earnings this week. Southwest is expected to post modest gains, but at both American and United Airlines, the losses are stark. One reason is that fewer people are traveling because of the recession. But analyst Ray Neidel at Calion Securities says the airlines are also hurting because they bet that fuel prices would stay in a certain range. Instead, they turned volatile.
Now, with falling oil prices, they got to buy a lot of fuel at much higher prices because that's what they bought on their hedge.
The hedges will be running out by mid-year. Airlines will probably be more careful going forward, but fuel hedging is an inexact science. Analyst Norman Higby at WMP Forecasts says all the airlines are getting it wrong.
They're writing long-term contracts based on trends they can't anticipate and short-term fluctuations. And the only thing you're collectively getting are bad guesses and wrong answers.
But Higby's just one expert. Consultant Richard Abulafia with the Teal Group says ask five more and you'll get 10 more opinions on fuel hedging strategies.
Even though it doesn't give much clarity and even though it can come back and bite you, it still represents more clarity than we have.
Airlines hedge because knowing how much they'll pay for fuel, no matter the price, is better than facing the great unknown. Airlines are expected to return to profitability by summer, but not because they figured out the fuel hedge formula. Instead, they'll continue to cut jobs, tighten capacity, and hope the economy goes wheels up. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
It has been 77 years since a company other than General Motors was the biggest automaker in the world. But GM officially lost that title today. We learned today that last year GM sold 500,000 fewer cars than Toyota did. Of course, in this market, it's not like Toyota's doing so great either. One of its executives said today, hey, market share is great, but it doesn't really pay the bills now, does it? So car makers are hurting. Car dealers are hurting, too. And that's putting a bigger dent than you might think in some local economies. Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports on one California town that is trying to cushion the blow.
Victorville is a city of 100,000 in the Southern California desert. And Victorville Motors has sold Chryslers and Jeeps there for 30 years. But that didn't count for much when the financial crisis hit and car sales dropped. City Councilman Mike Rothschild.
They could not borrow money from the bank. Chrysler's financial arm, and they went to all the local banks as well. You know, they tried every avenue.
That wasn't just a problem for Victorville Motors. It was a problem for the whole town.
We've got an auto mall of several dealerships, about seven. They generate over half of our sales tax money, and sales tax is the biggest issue for this city because we don't have any property tax in Victorville.
So last month, City Council voted to loan taxpayer money to Victorville Motors, $200,000, call it a mini bailout. It's among the first towns to do so, but it may not be the last. Yesterday, the California city of Redlands considered a relief package for its dealerships. Dave Kushma of Automotive News says towns everywhere may have similar decisions to make.
There are 20,000 new vehicle dealerships across the country, and in many cases, they are the largest employer in the community. They make a lot of charitable contributions. The Detroit 3 automakers have too many dealerships and are trying consciously to reduce the number.
By as much as 10% over the next year. And Kushma says even if local governments give dealers loans, there's still the problem of public resentment. He says many assume the Big Three would extend credit to struggling dealerships, using money they got from their federal bailout. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
The World Economic Forum next week in Davos, Switzerland, is going to be a busy affair. The official theme of the conference, which was announced today, is going to be Shaping a Post-Crisis World. Last year, pre-crisis, of course, the economic scene was quite different. Instead of talking about ways to increase profitability, Microsoft founder Bill Gates challenged corporations in another way. He urged them to be more socially responsible, in part by engaging in what he calls creative capitalism. Exactly how that might be done sparked Michael Kinsley's interest. Kinsley has known Gates for a while. Microsoft used to own Slate.com, which Kinsley founded. And so Kinsley used a conversation with Gates as the foundation for a book about Gates' idea called, conveniently, Creative Capitalism. Michael Kinsley, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So a year ago at Davos, Bill Gates gives this speech on creative capitalism. Here you are with a book out sort of about that conversation. What was he talking about?
He was talking in general about the idea that business and capitalism as a theory needed to work harder to solve some problems like poverty in the third world, that even philanthropy on a scale that he practices it isn't big enough to solve.
What are the mechanics then? Do companies just take a little bit of their profits, a little bit of that shareholder wealth and spread it around?
He thinks that it's at least more organically connected to the corporation than just giving money. So Microsoft gives software and training to poor countries, and that is much more connected to its mission and even connected to its profits. And he would say that is much more what creative capitalism is supposed to be.
There are a lot of back and forths in this book, and a lot of really good points are made. I was struck by one of them, which was, you know, you're sort of forcing or legislating without the force of law good corporate behavior. Now, obviously, we hope for that to begin with, but you can't make somebody be good.
One of the possible solutions to that theoretical problem is something Bill calls recognition. He says people want to maximize their profits for themselves. They also want to help others. Adam Smith, you know, the king of self-interest, wrote another book beside The Wealth of Nations in which he actually discussed the innate caring for others that human beings have. And people also want recognition for having done that. And recognition is sort of, as he describes it, a separate currency almost that you can maximize.
This is a book on the power, really, of capitalism, if you think very broadly about what that means. I'm just wondering what you think about the timing of bringing this book to market at a point where capitalism, equally broadly defined, is under some siege here.
Well, first of all, the capitalism is going to outlast whatever problems we're going through now, and these issues will still be there. Secondly, surely the problems that Bill and others are hoping might be addressed are not going to get better during a depression. They're going to get worse. So there will be more need for this.
Michael Kinsley is an author. He's a columnist for Time Magazine. He's a founder of Slate.com. And he is also, most recently, the editor of a book called Creative Capitalism. Mike, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, economic challenges to our battles abroad.
Anybody looking for countries to spend a great deal on foreign policy issues not directly related to their immediate vital national security interests is going to be disappointed.
But first, let's do the numbers. The market rebounded today with all boats rising on gains in the financial sector. The Dow Industrials gained 279 points. That's 3.5% on the blue chips. They closed at 8,228. The NASDAQ grabbed 66 points, almost 4 2/3%, settling at 1507. The S&P 500 climbed 35 points, 4 1/3%, wrapped up trading at 840. Bank stocks came alive, as I said. Citigroup revived 31% today. J.P. Morgan Chase resurrected 25%. Bank of America rose nearly 31%. After State Street's poor earnings sent that stock tumbling yesterday, investors came running back to rival custody bank Northern Trust Corporation. That rose almost 31% on strong fourth quarter earnings today. Better than expected profit forecasts also recharged tech stocks. IBM gained 11.5%. Ahead of its earnings report, which came after the bell, Apple snagged almost 6% today. Microsoft bumped up near 5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases new residential construction data for December. The Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee discusses what states are doing to keep us healthy. And the House Armed Services Committee receives testimony on preventing weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, and terrorism. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, then, let's see. Democrats hold the White House. They've got strong majorities in both houses of Congress. Fallout from the financial crisis continues to wreak havoc on the markets, and more regulations are surely just around the corner. But commentator David Frum says that before Republicans start complaining, they ought to ask themselves some hard questions.
Like many Republicans, I don't much care for President Obama's economic plans. From our point of view, Obama is using an emergency in the financial markets as a cover to launch America into a huge, costly, long-term spending program of little probable value. Obama's infrastructure plans are bad ideas, but they do respond to a real problem. Even before the recession, even before the financial crisis, the income of the typical American worker was stagnating. After inflation, the median American worker earned no more in early 2007 than he or she had earned 7 years before. Under any circumstances, this wage stagnation would have done the incumbent party terrible political harm. But the harm was especially great in 2006 and again in 2008 because Republicans offered no plausible idea about how to get wages growing again. Worse, we refused to acknowledge the problem even existed. We said the Bush economy was the greatest story never told. We dismiss those who disagreed as whiners. But there are conservative policies that offer real hope to workers at the middle. Here are two ideas. The first is to reduce immigration flows. The arrival of more than 1 million very low-skilled workers, year after year, at least half of them illegal, has weighed heavily on the wages of less skilled Americans. The second is to throw open the national healthcare market to brisker competition. Right now, healthcare is regulated both by the federal government and the 50 states, with many states regulating in ways that drive prices up, not down. That's one reason there is no Sam Walton or Henry Ford of healthcare offering a reliable, inexpensive, standardized product nationwide. Instead, we have constantly rising healthcare premiums that devour potential wage increases. Some Republicans and conservatives might not like these ideas. Fine, do better. Because unless Americans are offered a better alternative, they will follow President Obama's worst one.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback: Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Today, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce floated its own plan to stimulate business. It's calling for billions of dollars in tax relief. The proposal would suspend income tax for 2 years when companies buy back their own debt. 35 trade associations have written letters to Congress in support of the plan. They say that'll get businesses out of the hole and spending again. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman explains.
Back in the boom times, profits rolled in and businesses racked up a huge amount of bank debt. Now they don't have the profits to keep current on the loans, so they risk default and bankruptcy. Since the loans are shaky, banks have discounted them as much as 50 cents on the dollar. At those bargain prices, companies may have the cash to buy those loans back and retire the debt, but they'd face a big income tax hit on the money they saved through refinancing. Economist Ev Ehrlich served in the Clinton administration. He's studied the plan backed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to temporarily waive the income tax on these buybacks.
This proposal says let the company go back to the bank and say we'll take an uncertain, risky asset off your hands and give you a certain clear and liquid one, cash, and we'll take the debt back and we'll save ourselves the interest.
The Chamber of Commerce calls the plan the linchpin of any economic stimulus for business. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Iraq and Afghanistan are just two of the problems the new president's going to face while he's in office. Foreign policy shared the stage with the economy in the inaugural address yesterday, but the economic situation here might well decide what Barack Obama can do overseas. Gideon Rose is the managing editor of Foreign Affairs magazine. Good to speak with you.
Good to be here.
Seeing as how foreign policy is a pretty big area, let's start with big picture first. How might the president be limited in his external dealings by the economic crisis?
Well, the new administration basically has very little in the bank account and a lot of debts that it's racking up. And so it's not going to be looking for any major new financial spending or commitments on foreign policy or national security issues. And it's going to try to wind down the conflicts that it inherited while avoiding any new ones.
Let's talk about some of those things it did inherit, though. Obviously, Iraq's not going away anytime soon. I was reading just the other day that the top NATO commander in Afghanistan is worried about the impact the financial crisis is going to have on allies and their ability to keep contributing. So there is an immediate impact, isn't there?
Well, there is an immediate impact, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with events. If the new administration could manage to wind down the American commitment in Iraq while still leaving something stable behind, everybody would be happy. The real question will come if the withdrawal from Iraq seems like it's producing chaos on the ground there, and then the administration will be forced to decide whether keeping its commitment to withdraw is worth having problems on the ground in Iraq. In Afghanistan, the problem is somewhat different. The Obama people talked a big game about Afghanistan before they took office, but I think it's a little bit unclear just how much of a ramped up commitment to Afghanistan they're actually going to make, not just because of financial commitments, but also because it's not as if simply doing a surge for Afghanistan would make the problems there go away.
Should he be worrying at all about whether or not other countries can continue to offer whatever military support they can, given their economic situation?
Anybody looking for countries to spend a great deal on foreign policy issues not directly related to their immediate vital national security interests in coming years is going to be disappointed.
You know, diplomacy in foreign affairs is obviously about more than just active engagement with military forces. There are strategic relationships you have to manage. And the two that come to my mind are China and Russia, both of whom are military powers, but also huge economic forces.
Absolutely. And I think here is where the economic pressures the new administration will be facing will actually play into the general diplomatic tack that it is likely to want to adopt for other reasons as well. I think you're going to see a cooling down rather than a heating up of U.S. relations with other great powers, even though there are things that both Russia and China have done and will continue to do that are not things that the administration approves of or will approve of. The fact is, it's going to be relatively quiet. The administration wants room to concentrate on its domestic problems and wants to not pick any new fights.
Do you perceive, or do you think other countries perceive the United States to be weakened in the diplomatic arena because of its economic problems?
You know, that's a very interesting question. The United States is hurting, but the fact is that other countries are hurting even more. And in the long run, I think that democracies and free market systems, even modified free market systems as the United States will be in the era that we're entering, will come out of this better off than regimes that are more sclerotic and top-down and authoritarian, which will find it harder to make the kinds of adjustments and thrive in a new world going forward. So I think that the supposed long-term impact on American decline is overstated. That said, in the short term, Washington is going to be basically hurt and distracted by this. And if it does try to throw its weight around, others might not listen in the short term.
Gideon Rose is the managing editor of Foreign Affairs Magazine. Mr. Rose, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of people it's really hard to feel sorry for. Donald Trump's Atlantic City casinos are apparently in some trouble. Revenue's down. There's competition from slot machines in Pennsylvania. Share prices have fallen from $25 two years ago to 25 cents at the close today. And they've got $1.25 billion bond restructuring that's due this afternoon. If the Donald can't get it done, his casinos would hit the bankruptcy jackpot for the fourth time in 17 years. To which one can only say, everybody now, you're fired. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow jumped 279 points, 3.5%. The NASDAQ gained 66 points, 4.6%. The S&P 500 bumped up 35 points, 4.25% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, rules for schools when the economy is in the dumps.
Schools can play a much larger role in being engines of equality. That's true, I believe, whether there's an economic crisis or there isn't.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.